Good morning, and I hope it is a good morning. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and you're listening to Law of the Land with all of us here at WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. We are here this morning to empower, to inform, to enlighten. We're here this morning. We are here this morning in the midst of a COVID epidemic, a pandemic, because it involves so many other parts of the world, in which we have over 5 million cases that have been reported, many, many more unreported, I'm sure, and 163,000 deaths in this country. Around the world, there are over 20 million cases, and we're almost to a million deaths at 737,000. And once again, I personally am aware of people who have lost the fight for their lives, and it was contributed to or attributed to natural causes. And when I say attributed to natural causes, I mean that they died with COVID in their homes. And when the body was collected, the death certificate later on was given to the survivors as death by natural causes. So we really don't know how many people have this disease, how many people have died from it. And our prayers go to those family members and all those who are wrestling with this and with the fear of contracting it, and with their loved ones who live in places where they are vulnerable, as mine do. The focus of this program today, and I want you to understand this very clearly, this is part of a series that I will be doing on freedom of the press and freedom of speech in the midst of a pandemic. Now, I've given you information on freedom of the press, and we've had people on the program regarding protest, but all of this now is in the midst of a pandemic, when these are times that are extraordinary for any government. And usually during a time of governmental concern, such as war, governmental powers expand and our individual powers contract. And you can see that. The fact that the government is telling you to do something you don't want to do, which is wear a mask, that you can't eat in restaurants where you normally would eat, you can't sit where you would normally sit, that you have to follow certain rules and regulations or face a fine or some other type of punishment. Government-born punishment. That happens in time of concern, of national crisis, or even local crisis. But now we have to look at how this virus will then fuel a government that we know from the top down is in several different phases of chaos. I think New York State and New York City maybe on the lower end of chaos, even though we have some concerns and issues. However, from the federal level, we have a government that is being led by someone with fascist tendencies, who has determined from his viewpoint that his method of ruling this country as a dictatorship is more in line with Putin and a person you're going to hear today, Rodrigo Duterte, who is the president of the Philippines. We're going to talk about press freedom, and we're going to have a guest, a very special guest on today, who is director of a film you should see titled A Thousand Cuts. But let us look at first our freedom of the press in this country that's under assault and our freedom of speech. And then we're going to look at this this way in which a documentary film, A Thousand Cuts, about the crushing blows by President Duterte against the press, the free press in the Philippines, can actually imply in a way what our destiny may be if we do not get our act together and protect our journalists. So let's first talk about freedom of the press. We know that it is in the First Amendment. And our First Amendment is considered our civil liberties. So when you think about civil liberties, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, religion, et cetera, and the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's the last line of the First Amendment. Few people go to that First Amendment last line. They will probably put more of a hand on freedom of speech. But that last line, we have the right to petition, to ask, petition our government for a redress, a change, some way to remedy grievance, complaints, a problem. We have the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's the last line of the First Amendment. Now, let's look at politicians and freedom of the press, because we've been told very clearly by Donald Trump that he wants to limit the press, that he has derided the press. We know that he started off even as a candidate deriding the press. And too many within the press stood back and did nothing, thinking if you drag out that journalist from you know, a Spanish-speaking media platform or site, oh, that's not me. If you make fun of a journalist who has a particular pre-existing condition, well, that's not me. But then, little by little, we saw not only did our establishment so-called journalists, the traditional journalists, those who believe they should be well-respected by this administration, we saw them torn apart. We saw them denied access. And it was only when we saw this happening, hopefully some of you, that we began to understand that without a free press, we have no one to hold the government accountable face to face. We only live with the decisions they make after, without having someone within that same space asking them the tough questions. How are we allowed to ask our government the tough questions? There was a lawsuit that was brought against the New York Times and ministers in Alabama during the civil rights movement. This was a very young Dr. Martin Luther King who was working in Alabama. If you have a chance to visit the sites in Alabama, you should. And he was being attacked by police. He was being arrested or stopped, detained. Again and again, this harassment was going on at Alabama State University, which is the HBCU, historically black college, in Montgomery, Alabama, was being scrutinized, attacked, under harassment by the local police department. The students there were. And so there was a letter written to the New York Times. Heed their rising voices. You can read the letter online. Use that phone of yours for more than text messaging and banal telephone calls. Heed, H-E-E-D, their rising voices. This letter was sent to the New York Times, paid for to be placed in the New York Times as commercial advertisement space to give the rest of the country, because back then, just like now, the New York Times was that newspaper of record that was read by people in the highest echelons and around the world. And so this letter, Heed the Rising Voices, pointed out these things that were going on in Montgomery, Alabama. And the head of the police department in Montgomery, Alabama, last name of Sullivan, sued the New York Times for defamation. Defamation is the publishing of an untruth. And so we have libel, which is the written publishing of an untruth. And we have slander, which is the spoken publishment of an untruth. Because we publish when we say something, the same thing. If we speak in untruth, that's publishing it out verbally. Or you can write the untruth and then it's written and that's libel. And that's the difference. Those are the two different types of defamation. And defamation would be a civil case. In this civil case, the New York Times lost at the trial level, even though Sullivan's name was not even mentioned. The reason why this is important for you to understand is because as early as the 1950s and 60s, These defamation laws were put in place to prevent the civil rights activists from saying anything against public officials who were harassing, arresting, and sometimes acting in ways in which it was a mob violence against civil rights activists. And so in order to shut down that protest that is guaranteed under the First Amendment, these defamation laws were put in place. And if you can imagine $250,000, $500,000 in damages being allotted to these people whose names are not even listed in this letter, Heed Their Rising Voices. It just points out what's in there. And there are some discrepancies that Martin Luther King was arrested 7 times, they say in a letter, when it was actually 4 times. And his house was firebombed, you know, that might hurt his family. And they said, oh, it didn't really hurt his family because, you know, his family wasn't home at the time. And these discrepancies, they said, led to this awarding of this damages suit. Read the case. The case is public record. It goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then that is how we get our freedom so that we can criticize, we can petition the government for a redress of grievances without worrying about a defamation lawsuit based on the Supreme Court ruling in 1964 that a politician must show actual malice and a reckless disregard for the truth in order to be awarded, to win a defamation suit and be awarded damages. To win that suit, they must meet this very high, difficult standard. And that's why you can see the criticisms of people who are in government can be allowed based on that case of New York Times versus Sullivan and based on our First Amendment rights. I want us, when we return, to talk about what's going on in the Philippines, because it could be a precursor to what is happening here. We'll be right back with our guest, Ramona S. Diaz, the director of 1000 Cuts, right after this musical break.
What have I gotta do to make you love me? What have I gotta do to make you care? What do I do when lightning strikes me? And the way to find you're not there. What do I do to make you want me? What have I got to do to be heard? What do I say when it's all over? And sorry seems to be the hardest word. So sad, it's a sad, sad situation, and it's getting more and more uncertain.
Yes, Joe Cocker. Sorry seems to be the hardest word, and it's a sad, sad situation we have encountered in this country, not just with freedom of speech and freedom of the press, so many freedoms that are being whittled away, chopped at, and now in our very eyes, in our lifetime, hauled away by trucks with secret police and tear gas. But we want to talk about not just what's happening here, but what's happening globally. And we can better understand our situation when we look at the situation that's taking place in the Philippines. We have with us today director of 1000 Cuts, a documentary film on the crush on press freedoms in the Philippines, Ramona S. Diaz. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thanks, Gloria, for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, you are the producer, you've written this, you're a director, and I watched this film, and I had to actually perhaps a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, think, oh, this is terrible for things like that to be happening there. But we know, as is said in the film, Maria Ressa says that, you know, what happens in the Philippines will happen in other places. It's a testing ground. Tell us about this film. And to lead us into this trailer that we have, set us up for this trailer.
Yeah, so the film is about, like you said, press freedom in the Philippines, and it's seen through the eyes of Maria Ressa, who is a journalist who's really fighting, leading the fight for press freedom in the Philippines and globally as well. Maria started talking about press freedom and the weaponization of social media in 2016, when, you know, no one was talking about it yet. So she connected disinformation and the erosion of democracy and press freedom. She sort of put that all together and connected the dots. And she said, without all those things, with you know, disinformation, when we don't know what the truth is, that there can be no democracy. Basically, that's her basic, that's what she's trying to really tell people. And this film shows the process for which, you know, when she was persecuted, she started getting arrested. She got arrested twice within 5 weeks when we were filming her. And the film is set against the backdrop of the midterm elections in the Philippines in 2019, where the President Duterte in the Philippines basically won all his senatorial bets, won all the seats in the Senate. So that's what the film's about.
Well, let's go to our clip right now. We'll be right back to discuss more about it. Let's hear 1,000 cuts. This trailer is important.
Mr. President, is it important that people be afraid of you?
Fear. Yes.
Hello and welcome. I'm Maria Ressa.
Maria Ressa carries the torch of press freedom in a country held in thrall by a populist president.
It started with the drug war.
Do not do drugs, because I will kill you.
President Duterte began his administration with the drug list.
This is the drug industry of the Philippines.
He showed everyone a list. People on that list started dying.
I'm telling the Filipino people, it's gonna be bloody.
We demanded the government be held accountable.
Duterte was annoyed by our reporting.
You are a fake news outlet. They will be allowed to criticize us, but you go to jail for your crime.
We started getting attacked on social media. The government created disinformation networks so people have no idea what the truth is. I was getting an average of 90 hate messages per hour.
We don't even know whether we can trust the police to protect us.
Just because you're a journalist, so you're exempted from assassination.
We didn't even realize how dangerous it is for you.
Why are you crying?
Because I'm scared for you.
Maria Ressa has been arrested.
The charges against Ressa were aimed at intimidating those who challenged Duterte's rule.
If I fall, I stand up, break these walls.
So why should you care about what happens in the Philippines?
They test the tactics of how to manipulate America in our country. If it works, they port it over to the rest of the world.
Maria Ressa was one of four journalists named as Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Maria won't be afraid. I'm afraid for her.
What we're seeing is death by 1,000 cuts. Little cuts of Philippine democracy. We will not duck. We will not hide. We will hold the line.
And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. You were just listening to a trailer from 1,000 Cuts, a documentary film on the crush and attack on press freedoms in the Philippines that could be and maybe already is the precursor of what is happening and will happen in the United States. And I have as my guest Ramona Diaz, the director of 1,000 Cuts. Beginning with this opening, that you've given us into this light of the Philippines as a testing ground for what could be happening in the United States, probably during this election, if it's not happening as we speak. First, I have to ask this. Where is Maria Ressa now?
Maria Ressa is in Manila. She was found. She's still fighting. She's fighting legal cases. Let's start there. So she's fighting 8 legal cases, one of which, cyber libel, she was found guilty and sentenced to up to 6 years in prison. She's out on bail. She has brought it up to the Court of Appeals. If that fails, she can bring it up to the Supreme Court. But she has 7 other cases. So her cases really fall under, like, I think of it as 3 buckets, right? Because I'm not a lawyer, so I have to simplify it in my head. It's 3 buckets that sort of breed. So there is cyber libel is one bucket. Another bucket is tax evasion. And the third is like SEC anti-dummy, having to do with foreign ownership of Rappler, her on-site newspaper, like her on-site news magazine.
And Rappler, of course, she is the director and the CEO of Rappler. And Rappler is a major force as a media, not just a platform, but it has so many different parts to it. She has amazing, dozens of amazing journalists working under her who have held the government to account for long enough for the president and those who work under the president to become uncomfortable and file these baseless charges against her, leading to these convictions. And so one thing that I want to point out that's chilling in the beginning when Rodrigo Duarte has an interview with Maria, he said he's going to kill people. He said he has no qualms with killing people and that he had killed someone 3 months before. And he just says this. And it's just amazing. How did you feel when you are in the room? He knows that this is being recorded and he has no qualms with saying that he's killing people.
It was crazy. And he, you know, that interview occurred before he became president even. Right. So it was sort of like this campaign, his campaign interview. Listen, he ran on the drug war. He promised to wage a war on drugs. That was one of his campaign promises. And as you see in the film, hours after he took the oath of the presidency, he implemented the drug war. There were bodies in the streets, dead bodies in the streets. And yet his popularity rose, you know, because he sold this myth of law and order, right? He sold the myth of, if I get the drug dealers, low-level drug dealers, we're not talking about the kingpins, right? We're not talking about the big drug dealers. Low-level drug users and dealers, then it'll be safer for you on the streets. And people really, he campaigned at a time when criminality was on the rise. So law and order really appealed to a lot of people. And he came on the scene sounding different, right? He didn't sound like a politician. But in actuality, he's a vulgarian and a misogynist. And people sort of mistook that as sounding normal, like a normal person. To me, he doesn't sound like anyone I know, but he didn't sound like a politician. And I think that's what really attracted people. He sounded like, someone you can have a beer with. I think he sparked the imagination. So the numbers remain the same. He was very popular. I'm not sure presently how popular he is because it is, you know, COVID and the Philippines has been under strict lockdown for close to 21 weeks now. So there hasn't been a survey lately. But I believe COVID has really done him in, especially his popularity, because his response to the pandemic is the same as his response to the drug war, which is like a militaristic police response as opposed to a public health response. So, and people are really feeling it, and the economy is tanking. The poor, again, the poor are the ones who suffer most at this time.
And if someone happened to just turn on or click in to this program, they would not know that we are talking about the Philippines. There are so many similarities here. I don't think anyone would actually know that we're not talking about the United States and we're not talking about Donald Trump. Because, well, you know, basically, when you're talking about misogynistic and you're talking about the threats, Donald Trump said when he was running for office that he could kill someone. You know, he could shoot someone, you know, and he would still win. He, you know, of course, was recorded having these misogynistic statements. And still, 54% of white female voters voted for him in this country. And 29% of Latino voters voted for him. And so this populist movement that's taking place, not just in the United States, but around the world. What is the linchpin with the freedom of the press? Why is it so important, from what you've seen in this film, A Thousand Cuts, that freedom of the press must be something that's undermined in order for these leaders to continue to do what they do?
Well, they undermine the press. They go after the journalists and press first, right? Because journalists call, they shine a light, right? They want accountability. They call for accountability. So they question what power does. That's their job. That's why they're the fourth estate, you know, because power run amok is crazy. So the journalists are there. They're going to call you out if you do something, right, that's not legal. And so if you have something to hide, right, you'd be afraid of those journalists. They'll be the first ones to attack. And I think what Duterte certainly, and of course Trump too, is like they're gaslighting people, right? They're telling you that what you believe, what you hear, what you see with your own eyes is not really true. When you see it with your own eyes, it's taped. It's right before you. They're telling you, no, that's not really true. That's not your truth. So if you don't have a space for truth, if you don't agree on what's true, right, then how can you have a democracy? Because you have to have that public space to debate and agree that there are facts. But if the facts are fungible and you can't even agree what's true or not, what's factual, not even truth, factual, that it's raining outside, that right now it's daytime, then how can you have a democracy? That's why I think they go after journalists first, the press.
And when they're going after the press under these defamation laws that they are creating in order to protect themselves from being criticized. I spoke earlier in this program about that is something that happened in the 1960s. And previously in political situations as well, but in the 1960s, the way in which people who wanted to perpetuate white supremacy protected themselves against criticisms by civil rights leaders was to have defamation lawsuits brought against the civil rights leaders for hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to bankrupt these entities. And, of course, keep the lawyers afraid of handling the cases because they go after the lawyers, too. In this particular instance, Duterte and the people who are following him decided they would, you know, show the people, I guess, their way of handling the so-called drug war by having bodies in the streets. And so how many people have been killed, government sanctioned as we know it? How many people do you estimate have been killed by this administration?
So it depends on who you ask, right? And this is a reason Duterte went after Rappler to begin with, because they were questioning the numbers of the drug war. So if you ask government officials, they would peg it at like 4,000, which in itself that's a horrific number when you think about 4,000. But human rights organizations are saying it's closer to 27,000, up to 30,000 even. You see those numbers too. So there's a big discrepancy. But forget about this discrepancy even, right? I mean, just, okay, the government, like, has said that there are 4,000 victims of the drug war. And they say they're killed because they fight back. These people fight back. But a lot of these people have no means to fight back. A lot of the people you see are shot, you know, in the back. They have no weapons. But that's all. That's the narrative of the government, that they fought back and therefore they were shot, you know, in the process of arresting them. But they're also alleged drug dealers and drug users. But they're an easy monster, right? They're an easy monster to wrap your head around. And really, the bottom line, the end goal is fear, right? Fear of these low-level drug dealers and drug users, when really they're not really getting the, you know, the kingpins. And really, it is an attack on the poor, because most of the poor, most of the ones who have been, most of the victims, if not all, are from the poorest parts of the city.
Going back to your background, you've had many films before. I remember seeing Imelda, and yes, and that's why when I saw this film come through my feed, I said, oh, I've got to have you on my program. I've got to let people see the work that you do. I've gone to the Cannes Film Festival, and this, and I'm just very curious. Your background is a graduate of Emerson College and an MA from Stanford. Maria Ressa said she chose to go back to the Philippines to live. What did you choose to do?
I chose the opposite, actually. I came here for Emerson, to go to Emerson, and decided to stay. I went back for a little bit after the 1986 People Revolution in the Philippines, but then I came back to this country because I just felt like, you know, I tell Filipino and Filipino-American stories. That's what I do. And in my head, what I do is decode what's happening in the Philippines for a bigger audience, for a Western audience, right? American audience. That's what I decided to do. And then, of course, when my daughter was born here, then I felt like then I have a stake in this country, right? Because she's, you know, she was born here. She's a citizen. She's American. So I decided to make this my home. Maria's the opposite, which is interesting. She came to this country when she was 10. And then went to college here. Right after college, she went back on a Fulbright to Manila to find her roots and never left. So it's like I've never been an adult in the Philippines. I was a child there. I grew, you know, I came of age there, but all my adult life I've lived here. And she, you know, she's never been an adult in this country because all her adult life she's lived in the Philippines and Jakarta, Indonesia, because she was also the bureau chief in Jakarta of CNN. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I've decided to do. So I have, you know, Gloria, I have, I really believe in this country. I have an immigrant's belief in this country because I chose it. So it better work, right? And when you say you watch a film, you don't even know if it's the Philippines or the States or whatever. That to me is really, you know, I've always known the difference because I go back and forth. I go back between the Philippines and the U.S. And to me, there's always a clear distinction. I know where I am, you know, when I wake up in the morning. But when I wake up in the morning, I see journalists being, like, targeted in protests and CNN reporters being arrested at live television here. It sends chills down my spine. And I'm like, hey, how did this happen? How did it become so similar? It's really frightening, but I have to believe it. I have to believe in this country because I really, when you choose it, the more you believe in it. There's something about choice.
I thank you. Something about choice, and I think, and I am a true believer as well in choice and in free will. And there are so many people of color and so many women who have fought for generations in order to have free will and choice and seem to be giving it up too easily. What message do you think in our last moments, what message do you think that your film and your work needs to be heard by the people listening about that slippery slope from what you've seen and where we are and where we could possibly end up?
Yeah. You know, Gloria, I always say that I'm not prescriptive when it comes to messages. I always think my job as a filmmaker is to give the audience an experience of what it's like to live in someone else's shoes that they would otherwise not meet, right? But I just have to say at this time, I think to me, to really think that systems, democracy is fragile,
right? Democracy is messy. Democracy, but it's very fragile. All the institutions we've built over the years and the rights we've won are so fragile. If we look away and we're not vigilant, they can really be taken away from us. But they're worth fighting for, right? Because it is about freedom of expression, of everything you do, of, like you said, free will to live, you know, 100% as a human, as full, in its full humanity. So we have to be vigilant, and we have to really care and not be apathetic. I think apathy really is the enemy. We have to be engaged.
We have to be engaged. I thank you, Ramona S. Diaz. If you have the time to watch 1,000 Cuts, and you do, you should, and you will be engaged. And this film is out now in many theaters. Is it out now in streaming platforms? I want our listeners to watch it, and I appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much, Vanessa Diaz. I mean, Ramona Diaz. I am so sorry. Thank you. I've been moved so much, and my listeners know I rarely get moved this much. This film is necessary viewing. And it's chilling, but it's necessary for us to understand where we could end up if we don't get our acts together in this country. Thank you so much, Ramona, for joining me.
Thank you, Gloria, for having me. Appreciate it.
This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. And you know I do not get that moved, but this film is cutting. It's clear. It's there for you to understand exactly what has happened and how quickly things can change. The Philippines is a democracy, and the president of the Philippines is willing to kill in this war on drugs. And when you start to think about what happened in Washington, D.C., what's happening right now in Oregon and so many other places, then we can understand how quickly a democracy can turn on its head. We'll be right back after this musical break from Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. And be sure you're trying right now during this break to become my buddy, because I need you. And I am on a little bit of a mission, and I'm going to take the host's prerogative and talk about something that is so important to me personally and professionally. And so I give fair warning that the report on the status of Black women and girls is a publication that my nonprofit organization, the Law and Policy Group, publishes every 2 years. And the Law and Policy Group is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. If you want to give, please do. You would support the stipends or the work or the publication for this report on the status of Black women and girls. And I have with me, I'm proud to say, one of my summer research interns, Chrisline Pierre, and she's a rising junior at John Jay College, currently majoring in criminal justice with a minor in philosophy. And she aspires to be a defense attorney, and she wants to work as well with dispute resolution. And so, good morning, Chrisline.
Good morning, Professor. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners this morning. Thank you for having me today.
Good. I'm so glad you could be here. And she's representing our 6 interns who have worked so hard on this report on the status of Black women and girls that will be presented to the public on Sunday the 16th at 3:00, and you are invited, your listeners, all of you, or not all of you, because I don't think all of you can fit on Zoom, but those of you who can, please let me know if you want to be there for the presentation of this report on the status of Black women and girls, and you can contact me at GB Marshall, Marshall with 2 L's, GB Marshall at WBAI.org. gbmarshall@wbai.org, and you can receive the link to go to Zoom. That link will be available on Wednesday. So contact me, send that information in so that on Wednesday I can send you the link to our presentation of the report on the status of Black women and girls, as well as the report on policing that we are doing. And you're working on both of those, right, Chrisline?
Yes, I am working on both those projects.
And they have been working so hard. Since June, we've had these interns, research interns working. And so let's talk about the report on the status of Black women and girls and your presentation. What parts of the report did you work on?
I had the pleasure of working on the marital status section and the employment and income section of the report.
I was asking Chrisleen what she learned from the employment income section.
Yes, what I learned from that section was actually one of my favorite parts of that section was the subsections which talked about entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs. And what I learned was that these past few years, Black female entrepreneurs have been on a rise. About 39% of Black female entrepreneurs are aged 25 and 30 to 34. And in 2018, actually, 20% of all women-owned businesses were owned by Black women. And that number was approximately over 2 million Black-owned female businesses. And I think that was a great accomplishment on parts of Black women. And personally, for me, learning that information, I think it's a great data to have as a Black woman myself, that Black women are trying to be financially independent by owning their own businesses and working for themselves. I think that's a great quality to have. And I think it also gives minority women a legacy to leave behind, which I find to be very inspirational.
Okay. And what would you like to do when you know, in reading this information, what would you like to do as far as getting people to better understand what the report can do for them? Like, what is it that you felt would be beneficial to our listeners in reading this report?
I think for my majority of listeners, I think can actually learn a lot of the issues and accomplishments that Black women are currently facing in America and internationally. One of those issues being the gender disparity that Black women face. I think that's a really big issue that a lot of people may not know the facts on. And I think this report highlights not only that, but also a lot of other issues and inequalities that Black women face in society today. And I think it's a great resource because it allows people to actually physically have this information that is not so much easy to find online or in the public today. I feel like Black women are usually not accounted for when it comes to data. And I think this resource is a great resource to have because it highlights specifically Black women and other groups of minority women and the data in the current society.
And so well said. And as I pointed out, Chrisleen is a rising junior at John Jay College. And one of the other areas we researched, and that will be a part of our presentation given on the 16th at 3:00 via Zoom, is police-involved civilian deaths. And tell us about the research you did in that area as well.
The research I did for police-involved shootings, I was the lead researcher for the legal argument as it pertains to the use of force by police officers. And I found out that under the Fourth Amendment, the use of force is judged by an objective reasonableness standard. And this standard entails that on the basis of an objective reasonable officer on the scene, if they would take the same actions, for example, Derek Chauvin took in the murder of George Floyd. And because of those legal arguments, we can further push the notion that those officers and officers in many police brutality cases use excessive force that was not needed for those situations.
And we've had a discussion as recent as yesterday with our Committee on Police-Involved Civilian Deaths, discussing the legal Supreme Court standards that have been set and the different cases, eight cases that were cases involving qualified immunity. And there are two different standards here. And so we have the reasonable officer standard, and that's when you hear an officer saying, I fear for my life, and whether or not in using deadly force, they were acting as a reasonable officer would under those circumstances. But there are so few cases that it's difficult to know exactly what that reasonable standard should be for an officer at the scene using deadly force or using any force at all, especially when they draw their weapon, or in the George Floyd case, using the force of their body in a training method to take a life. The other is qualified immunity, and qualified immunity is the civil standard brought when a family who have lost a loved one through police-involved civilian force, then is suing for civil damages. And there are two different things. So we're going to talk about that as well on Saturday, on Sunday, the 16th at 3 o'clock via Zoom. And our guest speaker will have an appearance by Pamela Means, who is the general counsel of Mothers Against Police Violence. But Chrisleen Pierre, who's our rising junior, and I have to say John Jay College, where we have all types of majors and all types of students, and I'm always very proud of our students. What would you like to leave our audience with regarding their the value of the participation in our Sunday 16th program, if they were to take their time to actually, for free of charge, be in the audience to hear our presentation? What do you think that would be a good reason for them to tune in?
I think a good reason for them to tune in would just to be informed. I think today, in today's society, we have to be informed about so many things because there are so many things that we don't know. And it's because there's a lack of communication, a lack of information that is so readily available to people. And I think having this presentation and having it being freeing, anybody can come in and listen and become informed and leave the presentation feeling like, okay, they understand the legal arguments of police use of force, and they understand the status of Black women and girls in terms of their current state in society.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning, Chrisleen Pierre. And as stated before, our presentation on the report on the status of Black women and girls 2020, as well as the research information that's been gained on police-involved civilian deaths, will take place on Sunday, August 16th at 3 p.m. If you wish to have a Zoom link to be a part of this very informative session, please email me at gbmarshall, Marshall with two L's, gbmarshall@wbai.org. And the link will be made available to you by Wednesday. Thank you so much for joining me, Chrisleen, and I look forward to you being a part of our presentation and all of the interns. I'm so very proud of each and every one of you, and we will be able to give the information that you've worked so hard on to the public and help inform and, as you say, inspire and enlighten them. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Professor Marsha, for having me on today. It's been a pleasure.
And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We've talked about a number of things, especially we began with freedom of the press, ending with seeing our young people who are taking their responsible roles in this democracy and doing the best they can to educate themselves and to educate you. What are you doing to make sure this democracy doesn't fly off its wheels? We have an upcoming election. Have you participated in the census? Are you informed? This very day, the New York Times has, quote, arrests target press freedom in Hong Kong. Police raid newsroom citing security law, end quote. This is what's going on in the world that's taking place in Hong Kong. You've heard what's taking place in the Philippines. You see what's taking place here in the United States. What are you going to do? Don't sit back and feel you're too weak, you're too small, you're too powerless. We are the power, and we have to make sure our voices are heard. Support WBAI so I can continue to enlighten and inform and inspire. and you do one thing that's in your sphere of influence that you can set out in this world to say later on, when the tally is taken, because it will be, when the history is written, that you did something. You can tell your grandchildren, you can tell your children, you can tell your neighbors, I stood up when the time was tough, and we're in tough times. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being with me. I thank so much Ramona Diaz for the work that she's doing as a filmmaker and my interns. This has been Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I look forward to seeing you soon. I might take a little break, but I will see you on the radio.